This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's the second hour of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In his first term as Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan was widely considered to be one of the greatest UN Secretaries General. Today, however, many people blame him for the many shortcomings of this institution that he has led since 1997. If the United Nations has failed, in what way, if any, is Kofi Annan responsible? Is this an organization that has outlived its usefulness? Perhaps it should be changed. Perhaps we should have something else. Now, this morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about all of these questions. And our guest is James Traub. He's been a contributing writer for The New York Times Magazine for quite a while. He writes about international affairs, U.S. foreign policy, and national political issues, and he's been doing that since 1998. He is also the author of a recently published book about the United Nations and Kofi Annan. And the title of the book is The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. Farrar Straus Giroux is the publisher, and it's just recently come out. James Traub is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. People who are listening can call in. The only thing we ask of callers is people just are brief in their comments, and we ask that so that we can get in as many as possible and keep the program moving. If you'd like to join the conversation, you certainly may. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means that if it would be a long-distance call for you, if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana, or even if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Traub, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us.
Delighted.
We certainly appreciate it. And I think I want to mention here up front that you did approach Kofi Annan about being involved in this project, about writing this book. It was something in which he cooperated. You did have the chance to talk with him on a number of occasions, talk with other people who worked with him. So this was a book that had at least had some cooperation of,
yes,
of the people at the UN.
Very much so.
And that it is, I think it is fair to say that you have reason to admire Kofi Annan?
Yeah. I mean, it's probably worth also saying that a lot of people in the UN are quite unhappy about my book because, they think it's far too critical of him and in some cases of the institution or of other individuals. But yeah, I mean, I think that as a person, he is a thoroughly admirable fellow. I mean, he is, I think, to a rare degree, selfless. I think his integrity, to me at least, survived all of his trials pretty much intact. He's a very warm guy. He is an incredibly unpretentious, ungrandiose person. I mean, he will talk to my son in the same way that he would talk to a head of state. There is something, I suppose, in all that of his regal background, since both his father and his mother come from Ghanaian royal family, and I think that kind of the sort of the equanimity he has and that air of graciousness that he has, I suppose, must have their root in that.
Well, I mentioned those two things. I don't want to suggest that because people at the UN cooperated and because you had some admiration for the Secretary General, I don't mean to suggest that somehow that this book then is uncritical.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not suggesting that at all. Well, let me ask you then as a very basic sort of question, he is preparing to step down. I think officially he's there until the end of the year, but his predecessor, Ban Ki-moon, has already been, we know who it is, and he's already been formally sworn in. So now that he's in the last days of his tenure as Secretary General, can one say something generally, or what one would say generally about his performance?
Yeah, but obviously when you're talking about 10 years, it's very hard to reduce it. And I think you framed it perfectly in your own introduction. His first term was extraordinarily successful, and he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2001, and I think he deserved it. His second term was extraordinarily unsuccessful, and so you might well think, well, he must have had some skills in the first term that he lost in the second term, or he lost his mojo or something. But the fact is, what this really demonstrates is that a Secretary General has relatively little power of his own, and he is so much kind of a shuttlecock tossed around by the breeze of the larger political world, that he can be successful when he's in a kind of world which is sympathetic to the UN, and he'll fail when there's not enough space for him to operate because people don't want to give the UN that kind of space. And that's very much what happened to him. He had a relatively multilaterally inclined American administration in his first term, the Clinton administration, and then very much not that in his second term, the Bush administration.
Yeah. Well, I think that is an extraordinarily important point where people who either want to criticize the body itself or want to criticize the Secretary General. Certainly, I think that it is true that the power in the United Nations really does not reside with the Secretary General, that the power resides with the largest, most powerful countries, and particularly those that are the permanent members of the Security Council, and that the body itself is only as powerful and only as effective as the commitment of its member states, particularly
right.
The biggest ones and the ones with the greatest resources to apply to whatever problems that they think are out there. So, and again, you know, in fairness, if people go around talking about the failure of the United Nations, I guess I would say, well, you really have to talk about the failure of its most powerful members.
Right. Right. I think, you know, we can take any one of many examples, but if you look at Darfur will probably be seen as a stain on Kofi Annan's legacy. Just as Rwanda 10 years earlier was a stain on his legacy, though at that time he was the head of peacekeeping, not the UN Secretary General. Well, leaving aside Rwanda for a second, in the case of Darfur, because I was there during much of this time, I don't really fault him very much. I mean, I think he tried to raise the issue early, passionately, persistently, and so on, and he could not get a sufficiently serious response in the Security Council. The United States actually was the most seriously engaged of all the countries in the Council. Even the United States saw this as a second or third tier issue. And there are other countries, for example, Russia and China, which were absolutely determined to prevent any kind of robust action and so far have succeeded in doing that.
Before becoming Secretary General, he had held a number of posts at the United Nations, and as you mentioned, I think the last one he held before becoming Secretary General was that he was the guy in charge of peacekeeping.
Right.
How is it that he became Secretary? Why was his name put forth at the end of 1996 to succeed Boutros Ghali, and how is it that he became Secretary General?
It's an interesting thing to remember because we tend to think Bush administration unilateral, Clinton administration multilateral. Indeed, I just reinforced that stereotype. But the fact is that what happened in 1996 is that the Clinton administration felt they could not work with the incumbent Secretary General, Boutros-Ghali, in part because the Congress just hated the guy, but also because Boutros-Ghali was a prickly, difficult, arrogant figure who was not a very effective leader of the institution. And so the Clinton administration decided they would block his second term, which they did by themselves. And then the question is, well, who do we want instead? Well, Annan was someone who many American officials had worked with when he was the head of peacekeeping. And he was considered a very pragmatic, very effective guy, a bureaucrat, but not a bureaucratically minded person, clearly pro-America, and just kind of overall a guy you could talk to and deal with. And so then there was a long, complicated process of his being chosen over others. But in the end, he met with enough approval from the other members as well that even though he was seen as the American candidate, he was nevertheless approved.
Mm-hmm. The tradition has been that the Secretary General that Secretaries General are drawn from among the different continents, and each continent gets two terms, and since the man who came before Annan was also from Africa, Boutros Ghali, the tradition would have been for Annan to only be there one term.
Well, except that this was an unprecedented event. That is to say, because Boutros Ghali had been prevented from serving that second term, nobody said when Annan was first chosen, you're only going to get to serve out Africa's 10 years. And the fact is, he was so widely admired in that first term that His renomination was a matter of course. Nobody opposed it. And so the issue just didn't arise.
Yeah. And then there, just again, as another, we probably should remind people, another indicator of just how highly regarded he was, in that same year, in 2001, he received the Nobel Peace Prize.
Right. And again, you know, it's important to recall this because the institution is so diminished in recent years, and so is he. Mm-hmm. Well, so what did he win the Nobel Peace Prize for? You know, and the answer is he didn't bring peace anywhere. Secretaries General do a lot of this kind of peacemaking, but their powers are quite limited. Where they matter is in terms of shaping global debate on issues, because the Secretary General is a unique position. He is a member of the club of all the states, but he does not himself represent a state. He is this kind of transcendent voice, and so he speaks for everyone. And Annan chose very much not to speak for all the states, but for individuals. And so he was very much from the outset a champion of human rights. This is not an easy issue in the UN because a good three-quarters of the members aren't really liberal democracies, and they don't really believe in the idea that individuals are endowed with this whole set of human rights that we more or less at least accept rhetorically in the West. And so for him to go to Africa, as he did soon after he became Secretary General, and admonish all the heads of state there that they had an obligation to treat their citizens with the exact same sensitivity to their rights as did people in Europe, that was quite a controversial thing, and he was able to get away with it perhaps only because he was himself African. And so he spoke quite persistently and quite persuasively on issues of human rights and also on the issue of humanitarian intervention, that is the obligation to intervene in the case of gross abuses. He also talked about issues of development, AIDS, and so on. And it really was because of the way he tried to reshape global norms on a range of issues that he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, James Traub. He's contributing editor for the New York Times Magazine. He is the author of a new book, The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. Farrar Straus Giroux is the publisher. We have a question here. Someone with a question or a comment or would like to join us, we'll get right to them. The caller is in Champaign, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice that you came to Champaign to talk to us today. I have a question about the UN. You know, we look at it, this great democratic organization that represents all these different nations equally, but, you know, I mean, really it is just a collection of thugs and dictators with, you know, a smattering of democratic countries in there. And I think it's very interesting that in the UN, you know, the United States vote is pretty much equal to Luxembourg's vote.
Well, that's actually not the case, and if it were the case, the UN would be non-functional.
Well, it is pretty much non-functional. I mean, anytime there's an accident or a problem, the first thing they do is they put their hand out to the United States, and then any chance they get, they condemn us. They hate us. Or actually, that's not true. Any chance they get, they condemn Israel. But go ahead.
Well, okay. I mean, let me correct a few things. The most important one is that the United States does not simply have one vote. In the General Assembly, everybody has a vote, but the General Assembly is of very little importance. That's the part that's just a debating society. That's not the part that does anything. The reason we have peacekeeping missions in the world and the reason why the UN takes any action at all is because those decisions are made in the Security Council, where there's 15 members, of whom five are permanent members and have a veto, and we're one of them, and we clearly are supreme among the five. So we actually have a very large voice, and the reason why even the Bush administration, which is very skeptical of the UN, nevertheless uses it, is that they find it useful. If they didn't, they wouldn't. Now, it is absolutely true that a large fraction of the members really like taking a shot at the United States, and it is also true that a large fraction of the members are genuinely hostile to Israel. And so that raises the question, well, what should we do then? Should we leave? Should we create some other kind of organization where we just have democratic countries? That's not a bad idea. I'm in the middle of a debate on the blog about just this question, and I think there's a lot of points in favor of doing that. It's good to remember, though, that the biggest failure the United States has had at the UN in recent years was the failure to get agreement on a resolution to go to war in Iraq. And there the problem was not all these tyrants and thugs. It was that our own democratic allies thought it was a terrible idea.
Caller want to follow up?
No, I don't have any follow up on that. But why are they so anti-Semitic, and why do they kiss so much ass in the Muslim world when, you know, Israel is a democracy? One Arab democracy.
Yeah, well, for one thing, the fact that it's a democracy isn't obviously all that persuasive to non-democracies. Second of all, it's really, really a kind of a free pass for regimes to criticize Israel because Israel is unpopular in the wider world, above all in the Arab world, so it's really easy to get points with your public that way.
Democratic countries jump on board because they want to kiss Arab ass.
Well, I don't think it's only that. I think there's a genuine antipathy to Israel. And, you know, that antipathy, that popular antipathy, is naturally going to be reflected in the states. I think that's really deplorable. And I think if you look at the new Human Rights Council that the UN has recently created, the only country it's willing to criticize is Israel. So that tells you something not so much about the UN as about the state of world opinion.
That's very interesting. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Bye-bye.
Let me take up the issue of resources, because the caller raised the question about the United Nations and its need for it to go hat in hand to the member states to get the money to do whatever it's going to do. And you would expect that the bigger, more wealthy countries would have to bear a greater burden. That is also true. And the United States has been criticized off and on over the past, 20, 30 years at least, for failing to actually pay up.
Yeah, I mean, look, the amount of money that we spend for the UN, which you put everything together, which is peacekeeping and various other kind of operations, maybe it's somewhere on the order of $4 billion or so, that's pretty cheap when you consider that this is a big organization which engages in emergency responses to crises all over the world, that is humanitarian crises, tsunami and so on, peacekeeping, public health, and so on. So, I mean, if you think the UN is useless, yes, of course, that's wasted money. But the fact is, it's not a whole lot of money. And proportionally to our own wealth, it's actually not all that much. You know, the U.S. used to pay 25% of the dues. And in the late 90s, when you had a very conservative majority in the Senate, they basically insisted that we'll be allowed to reduce that. They wanted to reduce it to 20%. Then it turned out that we would then be paying less than Japan, and that was considered to be embarrassing. So the number was raised to 22%. But our percentage of global GDP is something, I don't know, maybe it's 28%. I mean, in effect, in other words, we pay less than our share of the world's wealth. It's not a big number.
Mm-hmm. You know, in over the past couple of years, in response to the criticism, some of the criticisms that has been made of the United Nations, the Secretary General himself has instituted a kind of a process of review, of rethinking of the possibility of making changes in the structure. And certainly some people have also addressed this issue of the problem of the Security Council. I don't really think anything there is going to change terribly much. But if you take a look at what has been said, what has been recommended, do you think that it is actually likely that some significant change in the structure or the way the United Nations works is in the offing?
Nope. I mean, I think that, you know, the UN is a political body, you know, and people always think that there can be a kind of technocratic fix. Well, you can't have a technocratic fix to problems that are political in their nature. For example, take the Security Council. Now, the Security Council really is an unrepresentative body, right? The five countries that have the veto are the U.S., China, Russia, France, and the U.K. Well, France shouldn't be there, and really neither should the U.K. But they're not about to vote themselves off the Security Council. Well, other countries should be on: Germany, Japan, India, Brazil. They were just proposed in this recent round of reform. That might be a good idea, but each one of those countries has various neighboring countries that would just die if they got on. You know, India has Pakistan, Brazil has Mexico, Germany has Italy, and Japan, above all, has China. Beyond that, let's say that somehow that succeeded and you expanded the UN and you made it more representative. Presumably that would be a good thing. But what if the countries that were added were even more unwilling to do the kinds of things that we would like to see the UN do? For example, act in Darfur. India, for example, is a country that takes sovereignty as being sacred, and they would say, no, it's absolutely wrong to be acting against the wishes of a sovereign government, even if that government is doing terrible things. And so you can imagine all sorts of reforms, and I think some of them actually would have real practical value, but you can never lose sight of the fact that the UN is inevitably and correctly the reflection of the order of power that exists in the world. It cannot be otherwise.
Let us continue here talking with people who are listening. We have a couple here in Urbana where we are. The next is line number 2. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to propose that one chief difference for Cookie Land's one of the chief differences in his second term is that in the first term he had a U.S. government which was basically pro-UN. And in the second term, he has a U.S. government which at least likes to act as though it would like to see the U.N. go away. And that the previous caller was a good example of the type of person who has backed this present administration. They really don't think the U.N. has any value at all and would like really be much happier if it weren't there. Could you comment?
Yeah, I couldn't possibly have put it better myself. I mean, I think that that's absolutely right. You know, one of the ironies, though, is this, that a couple months ago, finally in a kind of burst of frustration, the guy, not the Secretary General, but the number two guy, a Brit named Mark Malik Brown, gave this speech in which he kind of vented, and he said, you know, this administration actually does use the UN all the time in a million ways that kind of fall beneath the radar, and they recognize its pragmatic value. At the same time, they're really happy to license the folks at Fox and elsewhere to beat up on the organization. So they enjoy the political value of targeting the UN as a bunch of good-for-nothing, corrupt U.S. haters and so on and so on, even as, in fact, they make regular use of its legitimacy and so on. And so, you know, he was calling on them to simply fess up to the usefulness of the institution, which, of course, didn't get much of a response in the Bush administration. But it's just, I mean, it really is, it's just too bad that they have chosen to mine this obviously quite deep vein of skepticism towards, hostility towards, and so forth, the institution. And you see them now in the second term having a much more pragmatic relationship to the UN, using it much more. Look at Iran. I mean, it's actually been kind of a failure, and it doesn't speak well for the Security Council at all. Nevertheless, the administration has been conducting its policy on Iran through the UN. Same with Lebanon. So the administration is there now and is taking a practical view, but it just doesn't like to fess up to it.
May I make a short comment on the question of Israel? I think Israel gets something of a free ride in the U.S. press. They aren't quite as democratic as they seem. They have a very large, I think 700,000 Arabs who have been there from the beginning of Israel and are virtually disenfranchised. There's a large number of Arabs who, by international law, have the right to return, and Israel has never allowed them to return. They, of course, say that it would be destroy Israel if they did. Israel has, in the past, fired on U.S. intelligence ships during one of their wars and attempted to sink it in order to deny us access to their messages, apparently. They have in the past been responsible for the murder of a major UN official. And they have done something which comes very dangerously close to ethnic cleansing in regard to the Arabs. They're not all bad. And it may even be that they are as close as any state to a democratic state in the Middle East. But they're not quite as perfect as they would like us to believe. Would you care to comment?
Yeah, let me say a few things. One is, I agree with you that Israel gets too much of a free ride of the American press. I think the American people are denied the chance to have a really full debate over Israel's role in the Middle East. There are some things that you said that I don't agree with, such as the question of the right of return, which I think would spell the elimination of Israel as a state. The problem on the other side is that the Arabs get a free ride. That is, if you look at situations like the Human Rights Council, which has twice cited Israel for human rights violations, those may or may not be just. Let's grant that perhaps those citations are just. But if it's going to be only Israel, and if one is not going to criticize the government of Sudan or the government of Zimbabwe, or other states in the Middle East, well, then that certainly seems biased and perhaps also anti-Semitic. So, you know, Israel has a reason to complain that the UN is dominated by countries that are hostile to its interests. But as I said before, that's because so is the world.
We are at our midpoint here, a little bit past. I have another caller, and I'd like to introduce again our guest, James Traub. He's been a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, where he writes about international affairs, U.S. foreign policy, and national political issues since 1998. He has written three books, including City on a Hill and The Devil's Playground, and his new book, which is about the United Nations and about Kofi Annan, the outgoing Secretary General, is entitled The Best Intentions, and it's just out now. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And questions continue here to be welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's go to line one. This is also someone in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. Kofi Annan's reputation really plummeted in my eyes when the Iraqi food for peace, I'm not sure that's the label.
You're thinking of the oil for food.
Oh, okay. Oil
thing.
For
yeah, right.
Food. All the double dealings and the larceny involved in this, it seems to me that since Annan was the chief administrator of the program, he should have been able to see some of this going on. But, of course, I don't know all the facts. Could you edify?
Sure, I'd be happy to edify. And I do think he deserves some criticism for the program, but it's important to understand how the UN works. That is, people say, hey, he's the CEO of this organization. The organization screwed up. He should take responsibility. Well, the problem is the UN doesn't have a CEO. And what it has is a board of 192 members who micromanage the organization. And the caller was really right in calling him the chief administrative officer. That's what he is. He runs the administration of this place. But he has very little real authority. And so to blame him, or for that matter to credit him with stuff, is hyperbolic. So that's an important thing to say first. Second, the oil for food scandal was a real scandal. But exactly who did it belong to? Yes, in part to the UN professionals who ran it, and therefore Kofi Annan at its top. But several things. One, there's no evidence that, well, more broadly, there's relatively little evidence of corrupt benefit on the part of any UN professional. There was one terrible case where the guy who actually was day-to-day in charge of the program appears to have stolen $160,000. Still, when you think about the fact that something like $60 billion went through this program, that's pretty tiny. Nothing attached to Kofi. There was an issue involving his son, but the son was very peripherally connected to the program, and I think that was mostly a canard that was used by folks who were really eager to bash the UN. Finally, it wasn't only the UN who knew about the bad stuff. It was the countries who set up and monitored the program, which is to say the countries that sat on the Security Council. And so it was widely known that there was extensive corruption in this program, certainly among the United States, the UK, France, all those folks. And for various reasons, the feeling was, well, that's a price worth paying, given that we need to keep this program going. There was a kind of compact of silence among everybody. Everybody found a reason to overlook this, and in part for the very good reason that if the cost of blowing the whistle would have been ending the program, well, maybe the corruption was a price worth paying. So all I want to say is it was really complicated. There are a lot of villains, and Kofi Annan is by far not chief among them.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. Again, other people who are listening, if you have questions, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about John Bolton. He was President Bush's choice to be the ambassador to the UN. There was a lot of opposition in the Congress, and so what the president did was waited till the Congress was in recess, and then he made the appointment. Now his term is about to expire, and apparently the president has decided not to do that again. He knows that he would never be approved by the incoming Congress.
Right.
So Bolton is resigning, and we will have somebody else. And the thing that was always said about him was that, the question was, why would you pick somebody to be a representative to a body that he has continually said, why does this body even exist? You know, why do you appoint somebody to be your representative to a body that he has no interest in really supporting? If you just think about it, his tenure as the America's ambassador here to the UN, was he in fact as bad as all that?
Actually, it's a little like Kofi having two different terms. I think Bolton's first 6 to 9 months were terrible, and he did real damage. The next 6 to 9 months, he actually showed his intelligence and professionalism. Here, there's a very clear reason for the difference. When he first arrived, the UN was in the middle of a sweeping attempt at reform, which I think you briefly referred to. Now, normally ambassadors don't have a whole lot of authority. They're following instructions, and often extremely explicit instructions. But when it comes to the UN's own internal business, like a reform effort, ambassadors matter a lot, and of course the American ambassador most of all. Here, I think Bolton did a catastrophic job and harmed not only the UN, but American interests in the following way. There was already a long and rather delicate negotiation process trying to get consensus on important issues among 192 countries. Maybe it never would have worked. But Bolton arrived and said, I'm throwing this whole thing in the garbage can. I don't trust any of these people. We're going to start all over again from zero. And he then submitted a series of American, in effect, edited versions of the existing reforms, which in many cases deleted virtually everything. And he said, we can't accept this, we can't accept that, we can't. You had the impression that this guy was saying, what I care about is preventing bad stuff. That's much more important than getting good stuff, which is actually rather different from what the administration said, which is that there are a lot of things they cared about. They wanted to get a meaningful Human Rights Council. They wanted to get a clear definition of terrorism. They wanted management reform. There were a bunch of things they wanted. And Bolton threw a spanner into the works. And he also had the effect of licensing similar intransigence among folks on the other side, you know, the spoilers, the Venezuelas, Irans, Cuba, but also others like Egypt, Pakistan, Malaysia, who played an equally bad role. And so in the end, there was a kind of race to the bottom, and you got in the end a little lowest common denominator document. And I think that was really a terrible episode. Now, after that, when Bolton did what most ambassadors do, which is to say trying to manage American concerns in the Security Council, he did a very professional job. I mean, you know, in terms of issues on Iran, Somalia, Lebanon, you know, these are tough, difficult issues, and he's a real smart guy, and he proved to be more flexible than people thought. But the fact is, another ambassador would have done more or less the same thing. There, as I say, ambassadors don't matter as much. So in the moment when it mattered who that diplomat was, his failure was really a serious thing. Hmm.
Are there any thoughts on who would be likely to replace him?
Well, yeah, but I don't have any inside knowledge here. That is to say, the people you read about are, one category is Republicans who lost in 2006, like Mike DeWine in Ohio or Jim Leach in Iowa. Leach, I would guess, is too liberal for this administration. DeWine would be more their style, but I have no inside knowledge. Then there are a couple of current State Department officials. One, who's the number three guy, very, very professional guy, possibly also too liberal for them. And then another, the woman named Paula Dobriansky, who's the head of the kind of democracy promotion department in the State Department. And various other people, the most interesting of whom by far is our current ambassador in Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, who's a forceful, interesting guy, conservative, but I think not doctrinaire, and a guy who, from my point of view, deserves a vacation more than anybody else in the world. And so I think it'd be just fine if he got to spend some time in that lovely duplex in the Waldorf that's reserved for the American ambassador.
Well, let me also ask you while I'm at it, what your impressions are of Ban Ki-moon.
I've never met him. So I should say that whatever my impressions are secondhand. I've listened to him speak, but I haven't met him. So you get an impression of a man who is extremely circumspect, extremely cautious in public, extremely uncomfortable with the idea of being outspoken, a man who has lived inside his foreign ministry, basically, inside a bureaucracy for 40-some-odd years. Now, so had Kofi Annan, and expectations of him were that he would be a kind of quiet bureaucratic figure, and he surprised everybody. And so one should never say of Ban that he will be such a bureaucratic figure. He may surprise us as well. What I don't see in him is something that I think one can see in Annan. Annan had a searing experience when he was the head of peacekeeping with the failure in Rwanda and the Balkans. And I think that left a big mark on him. And it meant that issues of human rights and humanitarian intervention were very deep in him. I don't see what comparable experience Ban has had that would make him so passionate on those issues. So I'm concerned that that very important role, which Kofi Annan filled, that role of being a kind of public moral voice, may just not come naturally to Ban at all.
Mm. Well, I know, I guess in some of the things that I have read about him, there has been the suggestion that some of the most powerful members of the United Nations actually like the idea of a guy who seems not likely to be to make waves.
Oh, this is a strictly lowest common denominator job choice. I mean, that's how it works. I think ever since the one really great figure who was Secretary General, Dag Hammarskjöld, came along in the mid-1950s, who was, again, a sleeper choice. No one knew who he was, and that's why he was chosen. Then he turned out to be tremendously formidable. I think after that, the members said, we're not going to make that mistake again. And so every figure who has been chosen since then, or almost every figure, I would say, is chosen in part because the feeling is he won't make waves. Certainly that was true of Kofi. And in the case of Ban, you know, you ask yourself, why would the Chinese approve a candidate from a country which is within the United States' sphere of protection and so much of a traditional ally? And I think probably the answer is because they just don't think he's going to be much of a public activist. And I think that that the one thing that almost all the folks who really matter have in common is they don't want someone who is going to restrict their own freedom of action, who will be a kind of independent actor.
We have about 10 minutes, maybe a little bit more, in this part of Focus 580. And again, our guest is James Traub. He writes for the New York Times Magazine. His contributing writer has been since 1998, writing about international affairs and U.S. foreign policy and national political issues. He is the author of a new book. It is titled The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. It is published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. It's out in the bookstores now if you want to look at it. And questions here, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I think, as you said earlier in the conversation, that perhaps I don't know if this is generally how he will be perceived or how he thinks of himself, but the stain on his time as the Secretary General, the worst is going to be Darfur. And given that you said that the way that he was marked by the experiences of failures in perhaps in the Balkans or in Rwanda, then I suppose you have to ask the question, and again, it goes back to the contradictions of the body itself. But having said all that, why is it that we can't seem to do anything about this?
Well, here's where I really am qualified to judge, because I was basically sitting there while many of these decisions were being discussed. And it's pretty clear to me that while I do fault Annan for a failure of urgency and a failure of action in Rwanda and Bosnia when he was the head of peacekeeping in the mid-90s, I think in this case he acquitted himself pretty well. He may have been slightly slow to act, but what that means is that he didn't speak up in late 2003, but he did begin to speak up in early 2004. Now remember, that's almost 3 years ago. And in those 3 years, the Security Council has been almost completely unable to do anything useful. Finally, in 2005, they agreed to send in a force from the African Union, but they knew that force was going to be hopelessly overmanned, and indeed it was. And there was a period in, I think, April of 2005, when Annan decided that he would call the Security Council up to his office on the 38th floor, which is rather unusual, and present them with four options and basically force them to choose. And the four options were going to be, let's mount an intervention, probably led by the French or the British. That would be the toughest one, admittedly unlikely, but maybe that was the right way to go. Two, let's have a really forceful UN peacekeeping mission there. Three, let's add a UN component to the already existing African Union component. And four, let's just keep the current thing and see if we can improve it some. And so he sat with the 15 members of the council, and he said, okay, here's one. 15, nothing, no, nobody wanted it. Here's two, nobody wanted it. Here's three, nobody wanted it. Four, everybody wanted it. Let's keep it the way it is. So where does responsibility lie?
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that there has been a lot of talk about restructuring and reform of the body. And I asked you, did you think much had changed? And your one-word answer was no. Will nothing come of that effort?
Well, maybe I was being a little glib. But first of all, less came of that effort by far than was hoped. And I think maybe that's because some of the hopes were naive. I mean, you know, Kofi is an optimistic, idealistic guy, and he believes that if he gives people a chance to occupy the higher ground, they will. Well, they keep disappointing him. They don't. And so not a whole lot came out of that. Now, the fact is the UN is a badly run organization, in part because it was created to basically be a kind of diplomatic body. It wasn't created to actually do stuff and run stuff. Well, it's a vastly bigger organization now than it was before, and it does do stuff, and it does run stuff, and it does have to be more effective. And I think one of the real intense focuses of Ban Ki-moon will be to try to get the kinds of management reforms that will allow him to be at least a little bit more like a CEO and to have the kind of authority which will then allow people to fairly hold him accountable. Right now, the Secretary General is micromanaged to a comical degree by the General Assembly, which in effect is, say, by his 192-member board. And so that cannot be. He has to have control over the budget and over personnel, like in a normal organization. Now, will that be granted to him? I don't know. It's become a big political issue. As I say, in the end, everything turns into politics. And so the way it tends to get seen around the UN is developing world countries, the poor countries, tend to see the Security Council and the Secretariat as being tools of the wealthy countries. And so they don't want to give any more power to the Secretariat or to the Security Council. They want to keep it in the General Assembly, the democratic body of 192. And so there's been an unwillingness to make any of those concessions without which the Secretary General cannot be an effective leader. And I'm sure Ban is going to really try to pursue that issue in his first months. And I say, you know, good luck to him.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think certainly there are people who have lots of criticisms for the United Nations. I suppose some people who think it should just be shut down. Having said that, I think that it is correct to say that there are a lot of positive things that the body does, to the extent that its members are willing to back that and provide the resources to do it. But
right.
if you look then at the other side of this sometimes empty sort of debating society, the fact that people get up and say lots of things that never really go anywhere, does that actually perform some useful function, the fact that it's a place for people to get up and make speeches?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, letting off hot air or letting off steam, no, that's hardly a function worthy of, you know, having this organization in New York City. What is worth doing, though, is attempting to shape the debate. And so I do think that the Secretary General himself, his words matter, which is why he chooses them so carefully. So that thing does matter. The part, in a way, that people parody the most is the General Assembly, which no one knows anything about, but it's widely assumed, correctly in fact, that it's basically this, you know, pointless debating society. Well, alas, it is. And I suspect it's really not reformable. But it has to be there. It's the democratic part of the organization. And so, in a way, the trick is, how can you persuade the members who are very suspicious of the part that's actually more effective, which is the Security Council, the various agencies like the World Health Organization and UNICEF and so forth, you know, how can you persuade everyone to do what needs to be done to make those organizations effective? That's a real problem. Some of them, by the way, already are effective. I mean, the World Food Program and, as I mentioned before, UNICEF, these are semi-autonomous bodies that actually do a very good job. But the General Assembly is not, and the Security Council is perpetually plagued by the underlying politics of the folk of the countries who were members.
Hmm. I realize that in a sense we may be going back over ground so we covered again, but I sort of feel that even though that the body's detractors and his detractors will want to focus on those things that they would consider to be failures, if you ask the question, what would you say were his most important successes? That is, what did he really do right?
Well, look, let's try to be a little less ethnocentric for a moment and forget about what the world looks like to us and think about what the world might look like to others. Mm-hmm. If you are a citizen of one of the many countries in Africa where the UN operates its peacekeeping missions or engages in preventive activity to prevent war from breaking out, as, for example, say, between Nigeria and Cameroon. Well, you don't think the UN is a useless debating society. I mean, the fact is that UN peacekeepers have made it possible for there to be the first election in the Congo in 40 years. UN peacekeepers actually did bring stability to Sierra Leone, great enough that there's no more peacekeepers there. They've moved on to Liberia. The same process is now happening in Liberia. So in these really war-torn, broken countries that nobody else cares about, and the United States is not about to do very much about directly, the UN makes a big difference. I mean, for example, just I think today, the Israeli defense minister praised the UN peacekeeping force in Lebanon, which I was very surprised to see. So that's another important function that it's serving. And so the fact is, you know, the UN does a lot of stuff which no one else is going to do, and almost all of it has a very high rate of failure. That is to say, it, by its nature, it's never going to look like shining successes. The goal is much more, let's avert catastrophe.
So what now, with Kofi Annan stepping down as Secretary General, what will he do next? Do you know? You have any thought about
that? You know, he, I think, first of all, the answer is he doesn't know. I mean, I think he's had such an incredibly exhausting time. He's been so deeply battered. I think what he probably wants to go do right now is just take a rest, you know, take a long walk, which is what he likes doing. You keep hearing about lots of things. I've heard about a foundation that he allegedly wants to run. I've heard about a UN-connected kind of honorary position that he wants. I don't know that he actually wants any of them. I really don't know. I mean, what I would imagine is that he'll become one of these elders, like a Nelson Mandela figure, who will be called in to mediate crises in Africa, but also outside of Africa. And then I'm sure he'll teach classes, give lectures, sit on boards, you know, do stuff like that. And he'll probably have some kind of foundation in his native Ghana. But beyond that, I don't know.
How old is Kofi Annan?
He's 68, and though he looks every bit of it right now, he used to always be kind of a younger fellow than his age indicates, and perhaps he'll recover that.
Okay, we're getting close to the end, but we do have another caller here, and why don't we bring them in? This is someone in Kankakee on our toll-free line. Hello.
Not limiting yourself by concern for what is likely to be accomplished, what form of international organization do you consider would best improve life on Earth? Thank you.
What form of international organization do I consider the best of them?
Yeah, or maybe the question is, okay, we'll let you design one.
That's a great question, because there's this big debate right now, as I mentioned earlier. Would the UN be better if it only allowed democracies in? And a lot of really thoughtful people have said yes, because democracies really do have values in common. Democracies are willing to engage in these kinds of interventions. And I think that's a really strong point. My own guess, however, is that an organization that excluded the non-democracies, above all China and Russia, would have a lot of trouble operating. An organization that was intervening in countries that were not members of the organization, nor were its neighbors in many cases, would have a lot of trouble. My guess is that what the future holds is not an alternative organization. It is rather that the UN will increasingly work with other regional organizations like the African Union, the EU, the G8, and so on. And so it will feel less like this one bright star in an otherwise empty sky, but it will be brighter and bigger than the others, but it will be part of a larger constellation of organizations.
Yeah, well, it's difficult to imagine something else coming along that would be as large, have the kind of resources, at least have the potential of the United Nations, given the fact that the most important members should agree on what should happen.
Right, but I mean, there was the counter-argument would be, guess what, the problem is structural. You will never persuade Russia and China, at least not right now, to behave like good citizens. It's not going to happen. The antipathy of third world members to the kinds of objectives that we care about is not going to be overcome. And so therefore, the only alternative is to create an organization consisting only of those members which at least are willing to contemplate those kinds of actions. That's a strong argument, and I'm reluctant to say no to it, but I would say, A, it's never going to happen. It's just a kind of interesting rhetorical exercise, and B, it's all too easy for me to see the shortcomings of this proposed alternative body.
Hmm. You know, given the fact, the kind of things that you have, the other sorts of things that you have written about, it's not surprising that you would want to do a project like this to spend time with the Secretary General and with people in the UN and just kind of think about the body. But, you know, having said all that, what was there something in particular that attracted you to taking on this subject?
Well, you know, I like it. I mean, it's not even in the sense of I think multilateralism is good. No, I mean, this may seem perverse. I like being at the UN. I like the people. I find them very worldly, interesting, thoughtful. The issues that they dwell on are really interesting and important to me. So outside of everything else, I thought this will be a really delightful way of spending a year or two of my life, and it was.
Well, I guess at that we will finish up again with the suggestion that if people would like to read more on this subject, you can look for the book that we have mentioned here a couple of times. Again, the title of the book is The Best Intentions, Kofi Annan and the UN in the Era of American World Power. It's published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. I'm sure you could find it in the bookstore. Author is James Traub. He's contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, has been since 1998. Mr. Traub, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.